In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
I think this is an incredibly dangerous moment, I really do. I think it's very important people pay attention to what's happening in Georgia and indeed the wider former Soviet Union.
I'm Venetia Rainey and this is Battle Lines.
Regardless of who stands with Israel, Israel will fight until this battle is won.
I've made wartime decisions. I know the choices are never clear or easy for the leadership.
I just find bombs and I find dead people, but it's a really scary thing for me.
In this episode of Battle Lines, we speak to The Telegraph's Middle East correspondent Natalia Vasilieva about why the invasion of Rafah is back on the agenda and what we know about Israel's attack on Iran 1 week on. Then we catch up with Russia and Caucasus correspondent James Kilner to hear about the mass protests in Georgia and how a shadowy billionaire figure with links to the Kremlin is driving the unrest. It's Friday, April 24th, 2024. First to Israel, where focus is quickly shifting back to the war in Gaza after weeks of unprecedented direct conflict with Iran appear to finally be over, for now at least. Is Benjamin Netanyahu finally going to send the IDF into the last safe haven of Rafah, despite warnings from its international partners not to do so? I spoke to our Middle East correspondent to find out more. Can you tell us what's been going on in Rafah this week?
Yeah, that's something I definitely did not expect to discuss even 2 weeks ago, because at that time it looked like there was enough international pressure on Israel to hold off on an offensive onto Rafah. We'd been talking about it for a while. Israel definitely insisted that it needed to operate in Rafah in the south. But the international pressure, especially from the United States on Israel, in light of the increasing humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, made it look like that operation would either be postponed indefinitely, or at least it would be something not that we would be seeing on the horizon. But the Iranian attack on Israel, in a way, shifts the focus and made Israel look like it's under attack, and in a way reminded to a lot of people that the war in Gaza started with Hamas attacking Israel. So now, almost 2 weeks after the Iranian attack on Israel, it looks like the IDF operation in Rafah is actually going to go ahead. We're hearing increasingly that it's only a matter of time. In one of the surest signs that it's going to happen, it looks like Israel is preparing for some kind of evacuation of Palestinians from Rafah. We have seen satellite images from just outside Khan Yunis, the north of Rafah, which showed what looks like a tent city that Israeli soldiers are building, presumably to evacuate Palestinians who are currently staying in Rafah. And if we look at what Israeli media was saying this morning on Wednesday, it's not about whether this offensive is going to happen. It's more like about when it's going to happen. There's a lot of talk about the evacuation, how long it's going to take, from something like 3 weeks to 5 weeks, I've heard. Again, it's quite extraordinary that if Israel actually decides to go through with that, because Rafah is the only city in Gaza which has not been affected by fighting. This is something that has been relatively safe. This is also the place where most aid organizations have relocated. They would move their staff, their property from the north of Gaza to Rafah, and all of the aid operations that we've seen, all of the aid distribution is centered in Rafah, and this is where most of the aid travels from. We recently heard from aid organizations saying that that offensive is absolutely impossible and it would exacerbate the human suffering in Gaza even worse.
And we say the fighting will come to Rafah where it hasn't been before, but there have been airstrikes, haven't they? People are still dying there. It's not completely unaffected by the war in Gaza.
Yeah, absolutely. There've been airstrikes. I think just this morning I heard of an airstrike in Rafah that killed three people. It happens here and there. I'm talking about this on the fact that obviously when you compare it to the rest of Gaza, when you compare it to places along the border with Israel that have either been bombed out or willfully destroyed to create a buffer zone, or if we talk about Gaza City, which basically lies in ruins, it's not like that in Rafah. There's still some basic infrastructure left, like water mains and things like that, which is not present in the rest of Gaza. And that's why it's really important to preserve that. But from what we're looking, it looks like Israel is going to go ahead with that. But we're probably looking at a longer timeline for this offensive than previously. And it looks like if international players were to interfere, they might secure a broader agreement from Israel to let displaced Palestinians move from Rafah further north, possibly move to their houses or move somewhere in the north, at least where they come from, which will make things easier. But again, how it would look like on the ground is very unclear at this point.
Can you remind our listeners why Israel is determined to go into Rafah? What's the aim?
Yeah, so according to the Israeli military, there were 24 Hamas battalions in Gaza before the war. And again, according to their estimates, 20 battalions, 20 out of 24, have been destroyed. And the remaining four are, when we say destroyed, it doesn't mean that every single fighter has been killed or apprehended. There is an understanding that there are definitely Hamas fighters out there across the Gaza Strip. But at least in the rest of the Gaza Strip, the resistance hasn't been organized. We have seen sporadic attacks. In recent days, we even seen rocket launches from Gaza. But all of that appears to be more of a guerrilla warfare at this point, whereas Israel believes that there are still organized forces in Rafah. And also tunnels underneath Rafah are supposed to be where the Hamas leadership is hiding, including Yahya Sinwar. And obviously catching or killing them would be the main prize for Israel in this war.
And what are the risks? You mentioned aid organizations and how their supply chains and routes into Gaza would be heavily disrupted. But there are a lot of people in Rafah now, right?
Exactly. There's something like 1.4 million people in Rafah, at least. It's not a matter of them going somewhere else, because the vast majority of them had already come from the north of Gaza. Most of them had been displaced several times. A typical journey from the biggest city in Gaza City would involve several stops on the way to Rafah. So that was the point of the last resort for those people, and just not clear where they go from there. As we know, the border is sealed. Egypt is not taking in people. It's not accepting any refugees. That border is clear. Obviously, there's no way for those people to run on the other side of the border to Israel. So it really is unclear how you can move at least one million people, even in a matter of weeks.
I want to move over to the West Bank now, because one of the IDF's units has been, or we believe is about to be, sanctioned by the US over its actions there. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. That's actually going to be quite a landmark event if or when it happens. I think we should also clarify that we're not talking about sanctions in terms of asset freezes and visa bans as we would with individual settlers who have been sanctioned previously, or, for example, with Russian officials involved in the war in Ukraine. That particular designation falls under a U.S. law that prohibits the United States from supplying military aid or training to armies or military units involved in human rights abuse. So that unit is supposed to be blacklisted as such. It's called Netzah Yehuda. It's technically part of the IDF. It's an ordinary unit. There's nothing formally different from it, except for the fact that it includes a significant share of ultra-Orthodox men, as well as religious Zionist men. It's a unit that has been infamous in Israel for a number of years. And for those who have not followed Israel closely, it might sound like a surprise. It might sound really strange that the United States would go after a specific unit. I believe that there are obviously many reasons why the United States would want to go after it. But that unit has been notorious for various violent crimes that its soldiers have committed across the West Bank in recent years. apparently with little or no punishment involved. In 2022, a 78-year-old man, Omar Abdelmajid Azad, who also has an American citizenship, was traveling outside of Ramallah, and he was detained at an impromptu checkpoint, detained, handcuffed, thrown to an abandoned yard. Soldiers got to lay him on the ground, gagged him and blindfolded him. According to an official report of the incident, he died 1 hour later from a heart attack. That's just one of the violent incidents that this unit soldiers have been involved in. There was another incident also in 2022 when a Palestinian woman was driving through a road near the entrance to a settlement. The driver was asked to pull over. There were people in the car, including the driver was severely beaten, sort of left on the road. They, unlike the 78-year-old man, they survived. But both of those incidents did not involve, did not end in any punishment for those soldiers. And at the time when the 78-year-old Omar Azad was killed, the United States called for an investigation, and it raised concern, especially because we're talking about an American citizen here. But nothing was done. And when you look into the Netzah Yehuda battalion, there are lots and lots of incidents from, you know, minor one. I came across this incident when one of the soldiers decided to beat up a Bedouin man at a gas station. Again, nothing happened. Or when Netzah Yehuda soldiers smashed the window of somebody's home, broke in, threatened the family with a gun. There was an inquiry which ended in, quote, clarification of the regulations to the soldiers and no penalties. So it looks like the United States decided to go after people involved in such glaring human rights abuse that they felt that there was no way that the Israeli government was acting to that. And I guess one of the reasons for that is if you look closer at this battalion, a lot of soldiers who come to serve there actually live in the area. A lot of them are settlers. And for example, Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich personally spoke about the battalion, and he said that residents are happy every time the battalion is deployed because as a settler, for him as a settler, it makes him feel safe. So it looks like there was one way that the United States found to go after violent settlers to respond to a wave of violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Again, that hasn't come into effect right now. Israel reacted quite angrily. We heard from Israeli politicians from across the political spectrum who have said that it's absolutely unacceptable for the United States to go after an IDF unit. But let's see what happens right now. It looks like this is definitely going to be adopted.
I mean, yeah, what do you make of the Israeli argument? Obviously, these allegations are incredibly serious and should be investigated. But what do you make of the Israeli argument that the US is overstepping the mark and doing it during a time of war when the IDF is actively fighting to protect Israel?
Yeah, the IDF are definitely spooked by that because to them it opens Pandora's box in a way. It just shows that, you know, one day you go after sanctioning one military unit, next day, I don't know, you put curbs on military aid supply. Again, I have not heard about the Netzah Yehuda battalion involved in fighting in Gaza. It doesn't look like it will have any impact on the ground and what's happening in Gaza. It's more of a symbolic gesture. I think it's quite symbolic for the United States. But for Israel, it's also painful in this symbolic way, even though it doesn't have, it is unlikely to have any practical implication on the ground in Gaza.
Let's move on to Israel's attack on Iran last week. We believe it was Israel's attack on Iran. Israel has never confirmed or denied it, apart from one quite hilarious comment by one of the ministers, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who just tweeted, lame or feeble, scarecrow, the Hebrew slang, which appeared to confirm it anyway, but it's widely believed to have been Israel attacking Iran. They, we think, bombed somewhere outside of Isfahan. Can you tell us what we know a week on from that attack?
Yeah, I think we know much more about it than what we did about a week ago when it happened on Friday. Original reports suggest that it was drones that attacked Isfahan. I think the picture is more complicated right now. Just to give you a bit of sense of geography, Isfahan is located about 200 miles south of Tehran. It is home to a major airbase and an airport. It's also home to sites associated with Iran's nuclear program, including an enrichment plant. And the attack was also hugely symbolic because it happened on the birthday of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Originally, we suspected that these were drones that attacked the base in Isfahan. I think now the picture is a little bit more complicated. We know it from remnants of surface-to-air missiles, which were found south of Baghdad. So it looks like they were Israeli fighter jets flying over Syria into Iraq. Then they fired missiles, remnants of which were found outside Baghdad. It also looks like smaller, short-range drones may have been launched as well. And as a result of that, again, we don't have a clear picture of the damage because Iranian officials have been quite anxious to play down. From what we can see on satellite images, it appears that a radar station was struck in Isfahan. It's a radar system, Russian-made S-300, something that should be defending Iran, but it looks like at least one of the radars has been destroyed. There were burn marks on the ground if you look at the images. Again, for both sides, this was clearly symbolic. I think for Israel, it was very important to show the wide range of options it has, including flying fighter jets over Syria into Iraq, which we did not expect at all, launching different types of missile and attacking something as sensitive as Isfahan. Again, the nuclear facilities that Israel might be interested in are located deep underground. It was definitely not the target. The fact that a radar of an air defense battery was hit, obviously, it's not the end of the world for Iran. It does not impair its defense capabilities in a big way, but it just shows that Israel has this capability if it decides to do so.
And how have both sides reacted? Have we pulled back from the brink of World War III, which felt at some point last week like we were heading there?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to be the one to jinx it, but it looks like both sides have retreated to where they were. We probably spoke about it on the previous podcast that Iran and Israel have for years been engaged in this shadow war. And it looks like they were comfortable with that. They were comfortable with finding ways to hurt each other via proxy attacks in third countries as such. So the escalation that we saw last week, it looks like it actually took both parties by surprise. Israel was surprised that Iran did decide to respond in the fierce way that it did. And it looked like Iran was surprised that Israel didn't stop and decided to retaliate again. But from both Iran and Israel, we have heard very mild rhetoric. Iran has denied it. Iran has actually gone to great length to play down, to say that nothing was damaged. That I think there was one comment that really caught my eye. It was the Iranian foreign minister who basically compared the drones, he described them as drones, that hit Isfahan to toys. And Israel just decided not to claim it. We have seen throughout this war quite extraordinary incidents when Israel would claim an attack that previously it wouldn't. Israel still hasn't claimed the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, but for example, it has claimed assassinations of Iranian figures in Lebanon and Syria, again, in third countries, which it typically wouldn't. This time, the Israeli establishment, Israeli politicians have been quite restrained. And yes, there was some anger on the right wing side of the political spectrum, including Itamar Ben-Gvir, as you mentioned, that described this attack as lame. He represents a wide segment of society, but he definitely does not call shots when it comes to decisions of the war cabinet. And it looks like in how this response by Israel was carried out, it appears that sort of common sense in Israel prevailed, as well as this understanding that Israel has a major war that it needs to deal with. The war in Gaza is not over at all. It has to save the hostages. It also needs to respond to security threats in the north. The Lebanese border is still very volatile. And Israel simply doesn't have the luxury of opening another front right now.
So I guess my final question is, at the end of a very busy few weeks for a Middle East correspondent, what's shifted in the region? I want to call this the April War. It's really been a month of firsts in terms of direct confrontation between two of the most important players in the Middle East, a long simmering conflict. But what's actually changed now that we feel like we've reached potentially the end of it?
Well, it's been a real roller coaster, I can say. And I remember that as recent as a week ago, we were talking about Iran's nuclear capabilities, or are we going to have Iranian nuclear weapons in the picture? I think what we learned in April is that the red lines that we thought are there can shift overnight, as it happened with Iran and Israel, who have never engaged in an open warfare. And it just showed how fragile the situation in the Middle East is, because it looks like we're out of the woods this time around. But again, Israel has been operated so much that sort of mini war, as you would call it, started with Israel assassinating an Iranian general in Damascus. I would be surprised if that would be the only time that Israel tries to target Iranian assets or Iranian officers abroad. So we don't know what the response would be. We saw that Iran was quite vulnerable when it came to the Israeli response. It had one of its air defense radars damaged. But it doesn't mean that it will not reply and it will not hit Israel with the same force as it did on April 13th. I think that's the most dangerous thing, that we saw that those lines were crossed and they were easily crossed by both parties.
Thank you so much, Natalia Vasilieva, our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem. Now to Georgia, a country in the Caucasus that has made rare headlines in recent weeks amid widespread protests. I spoke to correspondent James Kilner, the editor of the Central Asia and South Caucasus Bulletin, about what has driven so many Georgians to the streets in anger. Welcome to Battle Lines, James. There have been massive protests in Georgia over the past few weeks, with thousands of people taking to the streets. Why? What's going on?
Hi, Venetia. Thank you very much. Essentially, the Georgia Dream, which is the ruling government party in Georgia, is pushing through for the second time in 15 months or 14 months, a so-called foreign agents law, which is a Kremlin-inspired law, which will make any NGO or media group which takes more than 20% of their funding from the West, essentially, put them under more scrutiny, allow the government to intervene in their internal affairs and to put them into special measures, whatever they want to do. It essentially gives the government more control over the media and NGO, which is really riling the average or most young Georgians, let's put it like this. This comes, I think, 13 months after a previous attempt to push through this Kremlin-inspired law was basically scrapped because there was massive clashes between police and protesters on the streets of Tbilisi. Riot police charging protesters, etc., that sort of thing. We haven't seen that yet this time round. What we have seen, we've seen sort of mass arrests, mass protests, reports about 20,000 people at any one time in front of the parliament, which is right in the centre of Tbilisi. So a lot of people, pepper sprays being used, that sort of thing, scuffles in parliament. It is getting very heated. This seems like a determined effort by the Jordan Dream, which most commentators and people in the streets suspect is pro-Kremlin or certainly Kremlin-influenced, to push through this very draconian law. There is one big caveat here, Venetia. This law has also been imposed in Kyrgyzstan on the other side of the Caspian Sea, former Soviet Central Asia, last month. So there is form here. It came in Russia in 2012. It was introduced in Kyrgyzstan last month, and it looks like it's the Georgian Dream in Georgia is determined to push it through next month.
So what's the broader context? What's the link that you're making there? What's going on in terms of Russia and its relationship with its former Soviet states?
So the Foreign Agents Law was a very important piece of legislation in Russia. It came in 2012, and the Kremlin said that it needed to introduce this law to improve transparency amongst its NGOs and media. But in essence, it was a way of clamping down on the West's influence. The Kremlin, as we know, is paranoid about these so-called color revolutions, Orange Revolution in Ukraine, the Rose Revolution in Georgia, so-called Tulip Revolution, various guises in Kyrgyzstan, etc. It is incredibly worried about the power that Western democracies can influence in society through NGOs and through media. It introduced this law in 2012, dubbed the Foreign Agents Law, which it then really did use to cancel, is probably the right way of putting it, cancel Western-backed NGOs and media. The wider context here is, through the imposition of the Foreign Agents Law in Central Asia, like I said, last month in Kyrgyzstan it was introduced, and it's being pushed through in Georgia now, we can still see how strong the Kremlin's influence is over its so-called near abroad. These are all former Soviet states. These are states which the West have been trying since the collapse of the former Soviet Union in 1991 to woo. Various times it's made progress, various times it's regressed. This legislation and the heavy-handed approach that the Georgian government, which is called the Georgian Dream, is taking to the legislation really shows how strong the Kremlin influence is, you know, to be blunt.
One of the people we've heard regularly criticised by opposition figures and protesters is Georgia's former Prime Minister, Bidzina Ivanishvili. He's described as the current de facto leader. What does that mean? What role does he play in all of this? And what do we know about him?
So this is the key. This is the linchpin, Venetia. Ivanishvili is Georgia's richest man. He's a billionaire. He made all his cash in Russia, actually, in the 1990s, in banking and trading, that sort of thing, in the wild days of the post-Soviet time when fortunes were made and destroyed. He's essentially an oligarch. He's Georgia's only real oligarch. He has very strong links with Russia and the Kremlin. He turned up in about 2011, 2012. He set up the Georgian Dream. His enemy was Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president, who was sort of at the time enemy number one of the Kremlin. And so Saakashvili had overshot his reach, his power, really. There was a war in 2008 between Georgia and Russia, which really marked the high point of his authority. 3-4 years later, Ivanishvili returned from Russia, apparently with a mission to reset Georgian politics. And he set up the Georgian Dream. He, through his wealth, he pulled together a lot of the Georgian population. His premise was a very sort of orthodox, traditional approach, which appeals to a very relatively religious, traditional country like Georgia. And he managed to defeat Saakashvili's party, United National Movement Party, in two elections, parliamentary elections and presidential elections, consecutively, so that by 2013, he'd secured control over Jordan politics. There was also a constitutional change at the time, which shifted power from the president to the prime minister. That's also important in the context, because he became prime minister, I think, only for about a year before he stepped down. Ivanishvili is a reclusive character. He keeps his own private zoo with lions, etc. He collects trees, like great big huge trees, and replants them in his own sort of botanical garden. There's an incredible film released about 2 years ago on cinemas in the UK and elsewhere, which really documented this. He's a massive eccentric, rarely seen in public. And he, you know, being prime minister didn't actually suit him. The understanding was that he didn't actually want to become prime minister. He was sent on a mission, apparently from Russia, to change Georgian politics. And once he'd done this, he stepped back. So by 2014, he'd really stepped back from frontline politics. So there was a few months where he came back in. But nonetheless, he essentially stepped back. The important date here was December last year. In December last year, the EU, or rather the European Commission, granted Georgia candidate status to become a potential member of the EU further down the line. This is a huge step for Georgia. This is something they've been trying to get done for ages. That happened in mid-December last year. At the end of December, Ivanishvili pops back up and he says, I'm coming back into frontline politics. I'm going to become the executive chairman of the Georgian Dream once again. And I'm doing this because I want to save the Georgian Dream officials, the government officials, from falling to temptation. Those were his words, very sort of abstract, a bleak thing to say. No one really. He didn't explain what this was, what the temptation was. He didn't go into more detail. He left us all guessing. That happened, right at the end of last year. Within 2 months or 3 months rather, his Georgian Dream Party had said that they're going to try and push through this so-called foreign agents law for the second time. So you have a very clear narrative where Georgia is looking like it's going to go down hard down this European route. The so-called Kremlin agent, I think, he's been called often, pops back up and says, I've got to stop officials falling to temptation. A few weeks later, 10, 12 weeks later, this foreign agents law rears its head again, and we have massive protests on Georgia's streets. Georgia is one of these countries where politics happens on the street. There are lots of protests. There's lots of confrontation between police and people. This is not going to end quietly.
Let's talk about that a bit. How do you see this panning out? Are we likely to see mass violence? Do you think the law is likely to pass? And what does that mean for the future of Georgia?
I think this is an incredibly dangerous moment. I really do, Vinicia. I think it's very important people pay attention to what's happening in Georgia and indeed the wider former Soviet Union, as I've been preaching on about for the last couple of years. The war in Ukraine has really exaggerated these fault lines. As I was saying, we have this law popping up in Kyrgyzstan. David Cameron, the British Foreign Minister, is in Central Asia this week, visiting this country for the first time, trying to plug migrant gaps in created by Brexit, but also trying to woo these governments to the West point of view. Armenia is to leave Russia's orbit. Azerbaijan is being very aggressive around the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. And in Georgia, we have Ivanishvili trying to suppress this very pro-European, pro-Western sentiment. During the war, the Georgian dream has kept Georgia, I suppose, neutral, but you could say even slightly pro-Kremlin. He's improved relations with the Kremlin and Russia during the time, which has surprised people. And now this foreign agents law has popped up. The way it's going to play out is on the streets. There's no doubt about that. The first reading of this bill, this proposal or this bill, was passed last week. There should be another reading next week, I think it is. And a third and final reading before it becomes law on May the 17th is the timetable. The Georgian dream dominates Parliament. There's no doubt that it's going to pass every single reading. The doubt is, the tension is on the street. That's where protests had previously stopped only 13, 14 months ago. This law for being rushed through. There's serious anger in Georgia, as we were discussing before we started this programme. The captain of Georgia's national football team has come out pro-protesters. Georgia qualified for the first time in its post-Soviet history for the Euro Championships, football championships in Germany. So this is a guy of massive status. The president, Zurabishvili, a former French ambassador, born in France to Georgian parents. She's now president. She was elected as an independent, actually, in Georgia, but allied loosely with the Georgian dream. She's come out hugely against this and said that the Georgian dream is not the Georgian dream, it's the Russian dream. So we're seeing a snowball effect. I'm afraid I can only see this getting worse and more serious. And I think we are going to have some sort of violence in the street. I don't know how heavy it's going to get. It's certainly too much at this stage to say we're going to have open conflict, but we're going to have some sort of clashes for sure. One analyst I was speaking to was saying that maybe the Georgian dream has generated this situation deliberately to stir civil strife so they then can then crush it and impose its authority. The elephant in the room here, Vinicia, is that there's a parliamentary election in October, which the Georgian dream isn't looking likely. I mean, it controls a lot of leverage, and it's been stuffing the constitutional courts and the election commission, etc., with its cronies. So it does have levers it can play. It has a lot of money. It can play some of the tricks that the Kremlin can play, but not all of them. But it needs more of an iron grip over what's going on in Georgia before the election. So I think before the election in October, we're going to see more and more tension and boiling in Georgia, potentially with violent scenes on the streets. Beyond that, we can't really say, but it's going to get messy.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's James Kilner. That's all for Battle Lines this time. Please join us again next week for more of The Telegraph's best foreign reporting. Goodbye. Battle Lines is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our news, analysis and dispatches from around the world, subscribe to The Telegraph or sign up to Dispatches, which brings stories from our award-winning correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a live blog on our website where you can follow updates on Israel and Gaza as they come in throughout the day, including insight from contributors to this podcast. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Battle Lines on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it really helps others find the show. As disinformation is a particular problem during conflict, we are relying on your support more than ever. Battle Lines is part of wider Telegraph foreign coverage in our podcasts. If you're interested in finding out more about the war in Ukraine, you can listen to our sister podcast, Ukraine the Latest. Battle Lines is produced by David Degahi, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.